This episode is brought to you by Creative Edge. Creative Edge specializes in getting exposure for independent artists, writers, and authors. They also specialize in arranging book signings, school or library events, or other functions pertaining to the arts. If you are interested in seeing what they can do for you, visit them at creative-edge.com. And welcome to the In the Mouth of Monster podcast. I'm your host, Monster Dugan, and with me today in the lair is my co-host, John Schatzer. How's it going, sir?
Pretty good.
So, how was your Thanksgiving? Did you do anything fun? Did you see any cool movies?
Very well. I watched my traditional Thanksgiving movie, which is the classic demonic killer turkey movie, Thanks-Killing. That's my go-to, or was my go-to, because I also watched Black Friday, which that's a new one with Michael Jai White, Devon Sawa, and Bruce Campbell, and that's another great holiday movie for Thanksgiving, and I think that might be my new Thanksgiving movie. So
yeah, that's a great film. I watched that, and it goes in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's a little Christmassy, plus they mentioned Thanksgiving and stuff, so it kind of goes to either one. It could really be for either holiday. Yeah, that's a fantastic film.
Well, but it's alien turkeys. It's alien turkey, so I lean towards Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah. But yeah, I saw that you had watched that, and you were talking about how great it was, so I went and gave it a watch. Once I found out that Devon saw it, and Michael Jai White, and Bruce Campbell in it, I was sold instantly, and man, that was one hell of a film, and probably the best thing I've seen this entire year. I mean, for kind of mainstream, it's not necessarily indie, but you know, it's kind of mainstream. But
well, that was it didn't have a huge budget, though. So
that's what I meant by it's indie, but it's got those big name actors, but yet it's which is probably where most of the money went was to those guys. But
there's some good practical effects too.
Yeah, Devon Saw is in that Chucky series right now, so he's getting all kinds of work all over the place. So,
cool.
But yeah, I really liked that film. That was a great film, man. Yeah, the great special effects and great acting, and I had a hell of a fun time watching that. So, yeah, that's going to be a new one that I watch every year as well. So,
and I'm getting my Christmas horror movie list together. I'm going to watch a bunch of... Well, it's stuff that I haven't ever covered for the website before. And I'm like, you know, I want to do some, I didn't do it last year, but I think this year I'm going to do it. So I'll just, let me grab this here. I want to run down what I'm watching and get your take on it. Again, I've watched other stuff already. This isn't like, my be all end all list, but there's a, Letters to Satan Claus, which came out last Christmas, and it's actually kind of a funny Hallmarky sort of horror movie. Weird way to say that. Silent Night, Deadly Night, I've never covered. Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, Jack Frost 2, because you know Killer Snowman, that's Christmassy.
I just purchased Jack Frost 2, and they are re-releasing Jack Frost, the first one, on DVD. And these aren't the Michael Keaton ones. These are the horror film ones we're talking about. And they're releasing that new one on the 14th. It's the first film, but they're releasing a new version of it on DVD on the 14th of this month. And I already put my pre-order in, so I'll have both of those. Those are two of my favorite films to watch during this time. But yeah, keep going with the list there.
Well, the original Black Christmas, I've never covered. I've seen it a ton, but I always wanted to review it. One I've never seen, but everybody talked about from about 3 years ago, that movie on Hulu called Puka, which looks kind of cool. One of my favorite movies.
Oh, I said it was all right. It wasn't all that, but it wasn't bad or anything. So,
Anna and the Apocalypse, which I've always enjoyed. You know, it's Christmas.
I have not seen that.
Oh, God, it's a Christmas movie. That's got zombies, and it's a musical. You gotta love it.
Yeah.
It's actually really well made.
There's a new one that people are talking about that came out called the Advent Calendar.
I've not heard of that.
Yeah, yeah, that just came out this year, so I'm gonna look track down a copy of that. One that you have heard and I grew up watching, but I've never actually written a review for this for anything ever, which is a shock to me. But Gremlins, I'm gonna review Gremlins and watch Gremlins. 2016's Better Watch Out, which I've been enjoying, and then I discovered an old favorite that I hadn't seen in years, but I'm going to watch it. And it's from 1945 and it's called Dead of Night. And it's a really cool British anthology of spooky Christmas related. They're all at this house for Christmas and it's all this weird, like, you know, they're sitting around talking and you get the anthology. It's fun.
Yeah. Awesome. So that was the list.
That's it. Yeah, that's what I'm planning on watching. Yeah. Of course, I got to have my annual rewatch of my new favorite Santa Claus movie, Fat Man. And And I also will definitely work in a Goldberg movie. Got to watch Santa Slay because, you know.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, which I didn't like that film originally, but it's grown on me and I really enjoy watching that one every year now. So.
But it's got horror icon Goldberg. Chris Kattan in it, dude. How could you not love it?
Right. Horror icon. Yeah. And horror icon Bill Goldberg, you know?
Well, but Chris Kattan was in the House on Haunted Hill remake. He was in this. He's in a Cowboys and Zombies movie. So horror icon Chris Kattan. I think it fits.
Yeah. He's one of the worst actors, in my opinion. But what was it like? He's Monkey not Bone or Chris something Kattan. Like that? Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's like Rob Schneider.
You know, it's a bummer, though. I always wanted that Mango movie. Mango. Remember his character?
Yeah.
It's like, Mango. I just, you know.
Yeah.
That would have been a great movie. We get a fucking Coneheads movie, but we don't get a Mango movie?
We got a Night at the Roxbury, but.
Yeah, that was an, I'm like watching that going, God, you know, that's really stretching it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's a one trick pony. It's that head thing. And I'm like, this is not going to work as a movie. And guess what? It didn't work as a movie. Though, the other Saturday Night Live movie that's criminally underrated is The Ladies Man. Get some Gavafier.
Oh, yeah. I actually really enjoy that. And I wondered why they never... You know why they never pursued anything extra with that? I always thought that was really cool. I love Tim Meadows. Great.
But it flopped. It didn't.
Yeah,
make
but any... yeah. But Tim Meadows. I was working at Blockbuster when it came out. It actually rented really well. So.
Yeah, but it didn't make a lot of money in the theater, and it was a one-trick pony. I think Tim Meadows is great, and I think he's really underrated. You know, Tim Meadows is just amazing in Hubie Halloween.
Oh, yeah. Did you like that film? A lot of people hated it. I thought it was decent.
Well, you know, people who watch it go, it's a stupid movie with Adam Sandler. Yeah.
Those are all Adam Sandler movies. They're all stupid. That's the whole point.
It's Adam Sandler and a bunch of his friends getting together and acting silly. And I liked it. You know, there were so many people in that movie. Everybody's having a good time. You know, and it came across the screen. So... people need to lighten up. Sometimes you can watch something dumb. It's like somebody was like, those Ernest movies are the same thing over and over and over again. Yeah. It's an Ernest movie.
Hey, what the hell, people? Movies, man. I love Ernest Saves Christmas, Ernest Scared Stupid. Those are some fun.
Ernest Scared Stupid is my jam.
Yeah, I love Ernest Saves Christmas, too. I already watched it this year because they threw it up on Disney Plus, and so I watched it because, you know, I have Disney Plus, so only because
I have all the Ernest movies on DVD and have for years.
Yeah, I rented Disney Plus or, you know, purchased it for this month only because I wanted to see that new Home Alone movie because I've seen all the other Home Alones, and, man, that was one of the worst ones, probably the worst one, where the kid basically tries to kill the guys who are trying to rob, you know, the couple. When they're not even trying to rob the place, they're trying to get a thing back that he supposedly stole. but it's basically he almost tries to kill him. But anyways, yeah. So I watched Ernest Saves Christmas because I saw it was on there, and you know I always enjoy that film. But I would just I wanted to say that this is one that I love watching. It's become my favorite. And I watch it every year now. I don't know if you've seen this or not. I want to get your take on it if you've seen it. But Rare Exports.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. I have a copy of it. I've had it since it came out. There's another one called Saint. Have you ever seen Saint?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great one, actually.
That's great.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying some of the other ones you might want to check out. The Dan Haggerty classic Elves, huh? You got Elves, Dan Haggerty, you got Nazis.
Yeah.
That's Christmas. Did you ever see the Christmas zombie movie called A Cadaver Christmas?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
Yeah. Yeah, they just put out it's a foreign show, but they put out, it's called Elves, and it's a horror show, but it's, you know, it's foreign. I don't remember what country it's from, but, you know, you got to watch it subtitled and whatnot, but I watched the first episode. It's not bad, so it looks pretty cool. So, you know.
Does it have Dan Haggerty in it?
No, no.
Well, then forget about it. But you got to watch Elves.
I watched, but I wanted to say I did watch Rare Exports in the theater the year it came out, and I fell in love with it ever since. And I just think that's, you know, because it's not your typical Santa. It's not something you normally see. So it's, you know,
A different sensibility. It's like Saint. It's a different sensibility and a different take, a European take on Christmas. And it's dark. I liked it. I mean, you know, it's.
And the father and son combo, and it had great chemistry because people don't realize in real life the father and son in that film are actually father and son in real life. So they're playing father and son in the film, but they're actually that in real life. So it kind of comes off as like realistic, you know, when you're watching it. But yeah, that's one of those crazy ones that I happen to come across and I've loved ever since. And not a lot of people know about it or you know, watch it. So I always like to throw that name out there around this time of year. So. But all right.
But seriously, watch Santa Slay because, you know, Chris Kattan, horror icon.
Oh, yeah. Well, and don't forget, like I said, Bill Goldberg, horror icon as well.
Well, Bill Goldberg's been in one horror film. You got to at least have two or three.
Well, if you consider his life a horror film, I don't know, because it's like
his wrestling career
is kind of a horror film as it is. But anyways, enough of our madness. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back with our feature interview. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
So you're going to pretend you haven't heard the stories.
I heard it was over some prank. Is that true?
Yeah, it was a prank. Do it!
What I can't understand is why you would pledge the sorority that allowed your sister to bully a girl leading to their death.
Come on, dude.
You wanna know how to avoid being killed?
How?
You be ugly.
What?
Seriously. You don't see ugly people getting murdered?
Tyler?
Jason and Freddy? Don't go after the uglies.
Are you out here?
Tyler.
Back at the In the Mouth of Monster podcast, heading into our feature interview today, and this is our Christmas special this time of year. So usually I try to do something, you know, holiday themed around Christmas. Last year we covered Axmas and Axmas 2 from John Ward. So if you haven't checked those films out, go check those out right now. It's a very good indie film. It's only about 30 minutes a piece, so not a long watch at all. There's a couple more coming out, which actually have my name attached to the credits. So beware for Axmas 3 and 4 when they do come out. I think they haven't been shot yet, but he's getting around to it. So with that out of the way, we have a special guest here, Mike Lombardo, who is the director of a film that I found really interesting and really enjoyed called I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday. So how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. It's good to be here.
Awesome. You're from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
Sure am. Home of the Amish Mafia. They do buggy by shootings all the time. So it's, you know, these this concrete metropolis. It's a jungle out there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of great filmmakers out there, man. A lot of people doing a lot of great stuff out there. We got Steve Rudinsky, Maddie Deering, Zane Hirschberger. There's a ton of you guys out there doing just amazing work in the horror genre. So, you know, I don't know what it is about Pennsylvania, but you guys are killing it. So
it's, you know, if it was good enough for Romero, it's good enough for us.
Right. I think that's probably what it is it inspires a lot of you guys to want to do stuff, being that you're from there. So. Which, hey, all the best films I've seen this year, well, not all of them, but most of the best films I've seen this year have actually come out of Pennsylvania. So, pretty cool thing.
Yeah, very cool.
You have a company of your own called Real Splatter Productions. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So, Real Splatter, we started that back in 2003, I want to say. It's kind of like a little indie film troupe that's evolved into various things over the years. You know, we swap people in and out all the time. But it's basically just the creative banner I put all of my projects under. It's mostly short films. We started with all, like, really grotesque horror comedies, like very offensive, gross-out stuff. And then over the years, kind of evolved towards a little bit more serious stuff. Our Lovecraft short, The Stall, was probably the first, like, attempt to do something more horror, like, actually horrific. So that played on the festival circuit for a while, and then that eventually morphed into going full-blown into a feature, which was I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday, which is completely dead serious and dramatic. And then the next project I have kind of lined up, hopefully, is going to kind of straddle the line between the bleak nihilism of Doomsday and the out-there weird humor of the old stuff. So I kind of want to shoot down the middle of the next one.
Awesome. Yeah, this is a really inventive film you came up with. And I noticed that took you a couple of years to shoot it. It was about 3 years or so.
Three.
Took you to finally get it all put together.
I mean, rewarding. Three rewarding years. Just lots of fun. 10 out of 10. We'll do again.
Hey, well, if you produce something as good as this film, though, I mean, it's kind of worth it, you know. They say that a lot of, you know, at least this is what I hear from a lot of independent filmmakers, is the ones that are the toughest to film are usually turn out to be some of the best films. So
yeah,
the ones that people are like, oh man, I can't stand this, I had such a horrible time on set and stuff, but at the end of it, when people view it, they're like, people love those films. So, you know, pain is pleasure.
Yeah, we were definitely living the misery for sure. But no, I mean, legitimately, I did love making it. Like, it was the best, I say it was probably the best experience of my life, no matter how stressful it got. Like, it was just fantastic, you know, just digging in and doing something wild like that.
So before we dig into the film and stuff, can you tell me a little bit about your co-host on the I don't know if it's a podcast or not, the horror show with Brian Keene?
Yes. So that show unfortunately has ended. Brian doesn't do that anymore, but Brian Keene is a very, very well-known horror author. He wrote, glancing at my bookshelf over here, probably over 40 novels at this point. He was a bit of a legend in the mid-2000s. He is responsible for bringing zombies back into the mainstream. 28 Days Later, the Dawn of the Dead remake, and his first novel, The Rising, are the three sources that are recognized as bringing the zombie craze back. So that's when I found out about him, was The Rising. Found out that he was local, and went and met him at a book signing, and then found out that half of the horror writing community is also weirdly local to me. So became friends with all those guys, and then Brian ended up actually producing White Doomsday. But they were between Brian Keene and JF Gonzalez and Edward Lee and all those guys, they were kind of mentors to me with my own fiction and film stuff. So I was very lucky to meet those gentlemen at the time that I did. I highly recommend checking out their books if you haven't yet. Fucking phenomenal stuff. They also, I think they've killed me. I've been killed probably in 14 novels at this point. And I've got a few books dedicated to me too, which is pretty wild.
That's awesome. Yeah. Do you write yourself? I think I saw something about you write short stories yourself, or?
I do. White Doomsday actually was a short story that was published back in 2010 or 11, I think. And that's how the movie ended up happening, was it came out in a book called A Very Strange House Christmas. It was an anthology. And then it got very popular. My favorite review when it came out, someone said they reviewed every story in the book, which all the stories are in this book. were completely like bizarro horror comedy stuff, like gross, like Doomsday did not fit at all. And it was the last story in the book. So all these reviews, like talking about how funny everything is, now fun. And then it said, and then I got to Mike Lombardo's story, I'm Dreaming for White Doomsday. And the review was one sentence that it wanted to slit my fucking wrists. I was like, wow, that's something. And then that kind of became like the going theme. Everyone was like, man, this was like really, really gut wrenching and depressing. And then everyone started saying, you should make a movie out of this. And I was like, how the fuck am I going to make a movie out of a post-apocalyptic Christmas movie? I work in a pizza shop. I have no money. And, you know, flash forward and here we are.
Yeah, which I, yeah, because I noticed that that's your only feature film so far. But I was going to say, as an indie, you know, a guy in the indie business myself, because I have just recently directed, I've mentioned this a few times on this show, but I've recently directed my own short film, which is in post-production right now. But man, the, you know, the time and the money you got to put into it, being your own producer and your own director and all that stuff, it's a task and a feat in itself. So, I mean, I applaud you for making something really great like this film, you know, on, you know, basically doing what, you know, working a regular job and doing all that stuff. So
congratulations on your first short, man. That's awesome. It's crazy, but it gets easier with every project because you learn how not to make a movie every time. And then the next one, you don't make the same mistakes. You make new mistakes and it just keeps building that way. But that's what it's all about.
Yeah, we shot it first and we made a bunch of mistakes. And so we decided to go back and do a second shoot. And between the first shoot and the second shoot, because those were our first two. I mean, I've done a couple of films in high school and stuff, but I mean, other than that, I hadn't done anything since it, you know, like 20 years later. So, but you know, the quality between the two films is just, it's so drastic. If you see the second shooting that we did, it's like the first shooting just looked like it's like, you know, like a high school kid basically. And the second shooting looked pretty professional. So yeah, I understand. I get that.
When we did the stall,
I did want to ask you.
Sorry. When we did the stall, we actually reshot the whole thing. The documentary, The Brilliant Terror, that just came out. I star in that and they followed me for 10 years. And the majority of my story arc in the doc is the stall and the constant reshoots that we did. We pretty much revamped it from the start. And that's exactly how it was. Every shoot, it just got better and better and better. And that's how it is.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about maybe going out and reshooting a little bit of mine again, too, just to make it even that much better. But, you know, I don't want to spend too long on my first short film. So I just want to bust it out.
It's never your project is never finished. You just stop. That's how it is, because every time you watch, you find new things you could go back and change. But you just got to let it ride with warts and all, and then move on to the next one and don't make the same mistakes.
I have a question for you. This is John here.
Hey, howdy.
Hey. So I'm an old school independent fan of independent movies, and something jumped out at me when I was doing my research for this. How the hell did you get a special thanks on Dead Shit and Nixon and Hogan Save Christmas? I loved Kevin Strange. It was sad to see him kind of stop.
Yeah, I met Kevin on MySpace, MySpace film. We were Hack Movies was one of the first MySpace films, along with Real Splatter. Like, and it's going to put a fucking age on myself there. And we met online when he was doing his first shorts, and I had just done my first few shorts. So we kind of bounced back and forth with ideas, and I would give him special effects tips and all that. I think I've got a couple little nods and stuff in a lot of the old Hack movies, actually. And then Kevin eventually ended up publishing the Doomsday story, actually. At the time, he had started a publishing house, Strange House Books, and that was the first stories I had published were through them.
Cool. It jumped out at me. I'm like, wow, Kevin Strange, there's somebody I hadn't thought about for a while.
Yeah, it's a small world, especially in the indie horror scene.
Well, did you go to GrossFest? I think I've seen you before.
I did not go to GrossFest. Justin Seaman, who runs Scream Team Releasing, goes there a lot. I could not make it last year because I had to work, but I would love to. But I do a lot of convention stuff. I probably run.
Tim Gross and I are friends. So.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So, like you said, small world.
Yeah, we actually just had Tim on for our interview for our Thanksgiving show that we did. Because he did Blood Freak, which is not necessarily a Thanksgiving film, but it's a turkey monster. So, I mean, it's pretty much a Thanksgiving film, you know, whether it is or not. It's if you got a giant turkey headed monster, it's pretty much a Thanksgiving film.
Yeah, it's the diehard of Thanksgiving films.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about this. I came across this, and this really piqued my interest. So you're a co-creator of the Hellraiser-themed web comic Cinnabon.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? I'm a huge Hellraiser nerd. Actually, we just put a book out. The Kindle's available for sale right now, but the paperback will be out on the 17th. But we have Nicholas Vince, Chatterer Centerbite, who he pitched in a couple stories for the book, so it was really cool to have him in.
That's
in the book
fantastic. That I've read a couple of his shorts. So, yeah. He's a really good writer, in addition to being a fucking setup, which is the coolest thing in the world. One of the things that I love above life itself is Hellraiser. I am obsessed with Hellraiser since I was way too young to watch it. So I had come up with a stupid idea for something probably close to 15 years ago on the way to a convention. And it was when they first started talking about remaking Hellraiser, like way back in the day, and everyone was up in arms. So I had this plot in my head. I was like, what if all the Cenobites, like the original Hellraiser cast, like if they were real, they lost their jobs because they, you know, they got recast by Dimension or whoever, whatever studio owned it. They got recast. So they had to get jobs at the mall. And I had this whole stupid shtick going with like Pinhead working at Hot Topic and like all this crap. And eventually, anyway, it turned into what if Pinhead worked at Cinnabon? So that was just like an hour long joke on driving up to like Horror Find weekend. Again, to show how old this is, with some buddies. And then I over the years, people kept bringing it up. And I'm like, you know, this is a really funny idea. Like we should do something with this. So I met a buddy of mine, Chris Enterline, who's an excellent comic book artist. And he was like, you want to do a web comic? And I was like, that's perfect. So we did three issues. We were starting to pick up steam. He got busy, I got busy, and it tapered off. But we were starting to make some real headway with it. We've been talking lately about resurrecting it because I have a full story arc for the first. Cenobon, The Sweet, Sweet Suffering. And then the second arc, Cenobon Tales from the Food Court. So two complete arcs have been written. We just got to do three of them. But essentially, it's a webcomic where the rub is that I only use lines from Hellraiser. Like I can only use unedited quotes from Pinhead for all of his dialogue. We just repurpose them to be about selling cinnamon rolls. it's a really challenging thing to write. But it's so fucking stupid and funny that I can't, like, I crack myself up writing these things. And it turned into, like, what started as a dumb joke kind of turned into a weird metaphor for my life at the time because I was working at I managed a pizza shop for 17 years. I was kind of just having an existential crisis about, like, where my life was going and what I was doing. And that kind of bled into the story. So the one issue of Cenobon is literally just Pinhead comes home from work, hangs his apron up, you know, he throws his keys down, which is actually the puzzle box, and he goes into the bathroom and he's just staring in the mirror and it just says, he just says, please, no tears, because he's just staring at himself. It's like, what am I doing with my life? And we had the original cover for when we were going to do an actual print edition. The cover is Pinhead sitting on the toilet of the bathroom stall with his apron on, holding a cigarette. And he has a Sharpie in his hand, and graffitied on the wall, it says, I am in hell, help me. So it kind of like a little bit more like weird emotional resonance with me, which is why I was really excited about it. So hopefully it will be resurrected, but it got a huge response when it came out. We started to get covered by a lot of the horror press, which was fun. And I almost gave a copy. We printed out like big 11x17s. I was so close to giving a copy to Doug Bradley, but I chickened out at the last second and I didn't do it. And then we had a friend at the time who was working with Clive Barker, and I was like, show him, please show him. And I don't know if he ever did. I'd like to think that he did, but I never got a cease and desist in the mail, so probably not.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of all that. So, man, yeah. So are those for sale anywhere, or can we look them up?
It's on the Real Splatter website. If you go to realsplatter.com and then under collaborations, it's on there. I think that there's a Facebook page for it that has the issues there. And I'm pretty sure there's like a DeviantArt page for it, I believe.
Okay.
But yeah, all three issues are out there. They're very short. And like I said, we have, I think it's like 9 or 10 more that I wanted to do that has like it actually turns into like a full story about the shenanigans that they get up to in there. So hopefully it will be resurrected. Much like Uncle Frank, out of a puddle of semen and blood, it will come back.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. You're a judge and a host of the Horror Night section of the Lancaster International Film Festival, and it says you serve as a judge for the Scares That Care Film Festival. Can you tell me a little bit about doing those?
Yeah. So I actually am no longer with either, because I got too busy. I just retired last year from that for the time being. But I was a judge for Genre Blast Film Festival, which is a phenomenal festival in that is the Winchester Alamo in Virginia, run by Nathan Ludwig and Chad Farmer. Phenomenal festival. I was a judge for them. I actually was the programmer for Scares That Care, so I was responsible for the call to entries, gathering all the filmmakers, setting everything up. That I did that for 3 years. That was a blast. It's just really, really, really exhausting, because I mean, you're talking, yeah. And same with the Lancaster Horror Film Festival or the Lancaster International Short Film Festival. I took over the horror night because there wasn't actually a horror section originally. So I was really trying to, because believe it or not, Lancaster, Pennsylvania is not the most horror friendly town. So I wanted to show the locals that there is a flavor of horror for everybody, no matter what they're into. So I tried to really program a variety of subgenres and budget levels and stuff just to give them like a full overview. And they were wildly successful. I mean, we were standing room only for the 5 years I did that, which is really great. We do like trivia. We had a couple guests. We had Paul Campion, who was one of the visual effects guys from Lord of the Rings, and he made The Devil's Rock, which is a really excellent like Nazi horror film. Brian Keene, Jeff Gonzalez, we had people coming out like that. So that was a blast. And then Scares That Care was obviously for the Scares That Care Festival, which our weekend charity is a convention that they donate 100% of the proceeds to families in need and children that are terminally ill or sick in the hospital. And so it's a beautiful, beautiful convention and charity run by Jill Ripple. I highly recommend checking that out. So the film festival was kind of a small thing there. And the 1 year they're like, hey, do you want to run this? So I really blew it out and did these big three events. And then I just kind of burnt myself out with it. But with that, I really wanted to showcase, again, filmmakers from varying experience levels. So there was a lot of people that got their first screenings ever at Scares That Care. And they came out and had a big Q&A. And then I had seasoned filmmakers come out too. Like, I really wanted to give a leg up to the little guy, because that's, you know, I mean, hell, I'm still there. But anytime you can send the ladder back down, I think it's important to do that. So we had a really, really successful time with all that. And, you know, eventually I would love to get back into the behind the scenes of film festivals. It's just a lot of work. I mean, you're talking 500-600 entries you got to judge, and then you've got to contact all the filmmakers, get the files. And the hardest thing is, if you ever submit to a film festival and you don't get in, it doesn't mean your movie's not good. It just means that I have 6 hours to program and I have 800 hours of movies to pick from. And it could be as simple as your movie is 18 minutes long, but these two movies are 7 minutes long. So the two of them equal more programming power than one longer short. It's so difficult, but it really gave me a better idea of what to expect when I was submitting my own films. I'm like, oh my God, I completely get this now. So I never got upset about a rejection letter again. I'm like, I get it. And I think that's an important perspective to have for any indie filmmaker. Your sound went out. There you go.
A lot of people take that as like, you know, they're, you know, like you said, that their film's not as good or whatnot, but they don't understand the process behind these film festivals. I actually just joined on to help out the Boston Sci-Fi Film Festival, which is one of the longest running in the U.S. So, yeah, it's going to be a hell of a task to try to help out and do what I'm going to do what I can. But yeah, I understand that, you know, especially having to do it all yourself and putting all that stuff together, that's a ton of work.
It is a lot of work. But, you know, the best thing about it, though, is you get to see all those films. You will learn so much about filmmaking from watching them, and good and bad. I learned 1,000 things not to do, and I learned so many cool tips and tricks and stuff. And then you get to communicate with these filmmakers, and it's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. I really hope that COVID kind of tamps down again, and then in-person festivals become a thing, because I miss being able to interact with these people so much, like in person. It's such a great experience.
Yeah, there's a lot of truly dedicated fans and filmmakers. So, I mean, with all that out of the way, let's head into your talk about your film here. I'm Dreaming of White Doomsday. So I really enjoy the title. Obviously, you kind of stole that a little bit. What was the thinking behind that?
The original title was actually Holiday Holocaust, which is the original title of the short story. But I felt that was a little too grindhousey, I guess. Like, I didn't think it was a really good, it wasn't a very good accurate, like, portrayal of what to expect from the short story and then eventually the movie. Although when I was doing the Blu-ray release, we had to come up with chapter titles. And I came up with a chapter title for the final chapter, and I was like, fuck, if I ever, because let me back up a little bit. We were selling the movie to distributors. We had some interest from Lionsgate for when I say interest, a blip, like a crumb of interest from them. And we had talked to Chiller at the time. And like a lot of these places, the first thing they said is, oh, you got to change your title because it's too long. Because short titles were in at that point. I guess they had never heard of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night and, you know, things like that. I love long titles. But the title that I came up with for the chapter stop was Christmas Morning. It was MOURNIG. I was like, fuck, if I had to change the title, that's what I would change it to. That's a great title. At least I thought it was a great title. But I was afraid when we were looking at distributors that because the first thing our sales agent said is, like, they're going to tell you to change the title and they're going to tell you to change the ending. And I was like, well, I'm not budging on either of them, so they can stuff it. And sure enough, every meeting, they're like, you got to change the title. You got to change the ending. And I'm like, oh, it's going to come out. And I just had this premonition of walking into my local Walmart and seeing it sitting on the shelf with a bad Photoshop cover and the title, like, The Bad Christmas or something with a gas mask. And I was like, no, don't want that. Or, like, Zombie Hands coming out, even though there's no zombies. And I was like, And then we went with Scream Team, and that was my first stipulation in our contract, was you don't touch the title, you don't touch the artwork, and we're not changing the ending. And, you know, it worked out great. But I love long titles. I love stuff like that. Like the behind-the-scenes documentary we made for it is called Armageddon from the Cheap Seats. So that was another long title that, you know, I love. But I think I'm better coming up with titles than I am writing films, actually. So, you know.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. This is a pretty good film. So tell me a little bit about, because you utilize the white mountains or whatever it is, hills behind where you live.
The White Cliffs of Kenoi, yes. So it was actually, so the opening scenes of the movie, you see like a barren apocalyptic wasteland, which is actually a combination of the White Cliffs and then a matte painting that a friend of ours, Raymond Doches, I can't pronounce his name. He is from across the pond, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce it because I'll just embarrass myself. But he did some great digital matte paintings for us to extend the set, because the way the clips were, it was actually it's limestone deposits. There was like a limestone refinery that they would dump. So it was essentially just industrial waste. They would dump it all on the edge of the Susquehanna River, and it just formed these like crazy mountains. And then there's like a cliff face, and then it's out in the Susquehanna River. And if you look out, you can actually see the smokestacks from TMI, Three Mile Island, which was, you know, one of the more notorious nuclear power plants in the country. So I needed like a big vast wasteland. So he actually extended the set digitally. He painted it to look the same, which is really, it was really wild to see. But yeah, we got to shoot in there. I wish we would have been able to shoot more stuff over there. It's just very difficult because it's about a 4-mile hike through the woods to get out there. It's actually like a park now. Or like a nature preserve or something. So it's just really hard. You have to go out like 4 miles to get out there. And then there's actually like ruins of the factory, which we actually used in the scenes where Santa's walking through the ruins of like the city street. That's actually partially the ruins of the limestone refinery, which is, I mean, it was a real lucky thing for us. Our buddy Taruga, he is like an urban explorer. So he had all of these abandoned locations for us to scout. And we completely got permits and filmed legally in all of them, of course, because, you know, why would we not do something like that? So our shooting schedule was very abbreviated because it was pretty much what we could carry on our backs, and we had to be in and out very, very quickly because you draw a lot of attention to yourself when you have gas mask Santa walking around, it seems. Yeah. So I also didn't have the budget to bail anybody out of jail, so we had to be quick.
Yeah, when I shot my short film, I played a monster in it, and so I was dressed up. And there was the cabin we shot at. There was a bunch of other cabins, right? But you know, within 20 feet or so. And so some kids were with their parents at one of them. They saw me in the costume, so they tried to run out there and, you know, and like started looking in the window and stuff. And I'm like, man, we're trying to film a, you know, a movie here. Like, can you not be looking in the window when we're doing stuff, you know? But yeah, so I get that. Is that kind of what led into you naming it White Doomsday, or
The title, because of the white was there. Story? Yeah. The title was there from the short story, but it's obviously a riff on I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. And I just think that Doomsday is just such an underutilized term these days. You know, you always hear Apocalypse, Armageddon. You don't hear Doomsday, you know? It just has a ring to it that I really love.
Can you give us a little synopsis about the film and, you know, what it's about?
So White Doomsday is about a mom and her 7-year-old starving to death in a bomb shelter after the end of the world, an unnamed apocalypse, which if you watch the movie, there's little hints and snippets of what happened. I think it's pretty obvious, but a lot of people always ask me exactly what caused the end of the world. And I always say it's irrelevant. That's not what the movie's about. But
yeah,
they're basically surviving in a bomb shelter after the end of the world. And it's a Christmas movie. I like to tell people it's Miracle on 34th Street meets the Road, which is probably the best description I can give as an elevator pitch. But really what it boils down to is just about the lengths you would go to try to protect someone you care about from reality. I had written the short story when my mom was in the hospital with stage 4 kidney failure. And it was really touch and go at the time. She fortunately made it through and actually got to work on the movie with us. But at the time, I was kind of watching someone I cared about fading away, and I was pretty much helpless to do anything about it. And just that feeling of despair and helplessness, kind of, I needed to vent it. So I wrote this this story basically about this mom trying to shield her little boy from reality, because in the movie and the short story, the little boy has, I mean, he knows things are wrong, but he doesn't know how bad things are. I mean, they're running out of food and the mom wants to give him one last Christmas just as like a final mercy. So, I mean, you've seen it. It's a pretty dark movie. It's not fun, and it's certainly not like a slasher movie, which I think that the cover kind of makes people think it's like a slasher flick. It's got kind of a vintage look to it. It's really like a slow burn drama that just gets very, very, very dark. So if you're into that kind of stuff, I'd recommend it. If you're not, probably not going to like it.
Yeah. Well, I love apocalyptic movies, and I thought this was, you know, fantastic. This was, I can't remember the one, but there's a film of like a guy in a radio station, and there's like zombies outside and stuff, but you don't really see too much of anything.
Yeah, Pontypool.
Pontypool, yeah.
I've never seen it, but I hear it's phenomenal.
Your film's kind of like that, you know.
Okay.
It's dark and you don't get to see so much. There's not a ton of action or any, you know, like a ton of blood or anything like that, but it's so interesting and just engaging and really captivates you and pulls you in, which I thought was fantastic for this, because, you know, being such an indie film that it is, you know, with only a couple of actors in it, which you have like, four actors in it,
yep,
four or five. And then, yeah. And so, I mean, I found it to be, you know, it's one of those, like, I came across it, I go, well, what's this, you know, and I had been friends with you on Facebook, and I go, oh, he directed this, I go, let me check it out and see what it's about, you know, because I like to do that whenever I become friends with people on Facebook, you know, that are in the indie horror community. I like to check out their work and see what they're all about, and so I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was, like you said, it's really dark, it's, you know, pretty twisted. I really liked the whole Santa Claus thing and how you did some of that, and so some of the questions I did want to talk to you about here were, so I was looking through and, so some of these things, like, so the bomb shelter was filmed in a basement, and the door was constructed out of an old, mattress box spring, vinyl window siding, and styrofoam painted silver.
Yep.
So you did it. And then, it says like the door's valve wheel was created from a PlayStation racing wheel with plastic bottle caps attached to it to mimic the large bolts. Like, that's some innovative indie filmmaking right there. Can you tell me a little bit about how you maneuvered around some of these things to make it look, you know, like you're in a bomb shelter and stuff like that?
Yeah, so the advice I give to every indie filmmaker I talk to is you need to essentially become Trash MacGyver. So you're obviously not going to be able to afford, like, you know, expensive props and everything. So you just got to learn how to build shit. And the bomb shelter door, you know, I was looking for like scrap metal, and I'm like, this is going to be way too expensive. How are we going to transport it? And I was like, what the fuck are we going to do? So I just kind of took the idea. I'm like, all right, what is a bomb shelter door? I just looked at the basic shapes of it. I'm like, okay, well, sets are built out of plywood and, you know, drywall. Like, it doesn't have to be functional. It just needs to look, or it needs to be functional. It just has to look, you know, like what it is. The audience isn't going to touch it. They're not going to feel it. You put sound effects in. So I was like, okay, I can make this out of foam core insulation, but I went to Home Depot and just started wandering around for like 5 hours. I'm like, all right, what can I make this out of? And you have to kind of go around and look at products and various things and just kind of disassociate what they actually are and just look at the shapes. And that's something a friend of mine, Scott Schaub, who did, has a band called Testosteroso, and he does all of our visual effects, and he's an animator, and I've worked with him with music videos a lot. He's really good at that sort of stuff. So he kind of inspired me to just, like I said, disassociate what things are. Like, I saw that motherfucker once make, he needed a an electric chair switch. So he found a children's slingshot and broke it and spray painted it, added some stuff to it and glued it to a light switch. And I'm like, oh my God, that, like, you wouldn't be able to tell that it's not what it is. I'm like, that's amazing. So I went and found all these random things and, you know, water bottle caps, you know, you spray paint them and you faux paint them to look like metal. You can make them look like bolts. I had done a big Halloween setup at my house one year. We had these huge Halloween parties called the Massacre-ade, where I would basically deck out each room of our house as a different, like, set. And I mean, I spent 6-7 months doing this. So we did for the Massacre-ade part two, I turned my entire living room into like a meat locker with human body parts hanging from the ceiling. And I basically, like, I wallpapered the whole room with contractor paper, which is what you put on the floor when you're painting, because it soaks up, you know, paint and moisture. I wallpapered the whole room like that, and then I faux painted it with spray paint to make it look like brushed steel, and put bottle caps and made big cardboard fans in the windows and backlit them so it looked like the, you know, the big rotating fans. And the bottle caps, I'm like, hey, this is perfect. So I just started telling everyone I know, I'm like, hey, when you drink a bottle of water, save the cap for me. And I would just put out these like random things on Facebook. Does anyone have like an old toaster or this or that? And just collect junk, much to my girlfriend's delight. I just had a garage filled with random crap that I would break apart and just kind of build into, you know, all this stuff. And if you watch Armageddon from the Cheap Seats, it's on the Blu-ray, we actually show step-by-step building that bomb shelter door and making the scroll and doing all the costumes like that. The door handle we actually took, I was at the thrift store, which is where I buy most of the props that we need for stuff. And I found an old NASCAR racing controller for a PlayStation. And I was like, oh my God, I could break this apart, make a few minor adjustments, and there you go. There's a bomb shelter door, and really 90% of any effect is sound effects. So we got some metal groaning noises and steel girders bending noises and threw them up over top of the thing. When we're on set, we're laughing our ass off because it sounds like squeaky cardboard or squeaky styrofoam when they're turning it. In the movie, it's like, and she's, you know, just acting and making it seem like it's this really difficult thing to open, and, you know, but the thing weighs, it's in my living room now, it weighs like 6 ounces, and it's, you know, I couldn't afford wood to build a frame for it because I found that it was too flimsy. So when we were trying to, we just essentially duct taped it to the back of the door that was already in the bomb shelter, which was my friend's basement. So it was shaking too much. So we broke apart an old box spring that was in the garage and used that wood and screwed it in to make it a stable frame for it. So every time they're opening that door, there's three people holding it up like it's a shield with this box spring, just making the movement and staying just out of the camera view. Because when you're doing a special effects scene or anything, all that matters is what the audience sees. You know, like, yeah. I love, there's a drawing that I saw once, the special effects guys, Rob Bottin, did on The Thing, where the scene when the head is stretching, Norris's head is stretching before the crab legs come out. And it was just a diagram of how they were going to do it, and it was three people, you know, under the table blowing cigarette smoke up through tubes into the neck of this thing, so the smoke is coming out, and like they're using melted bubble gum for the stretchy tendons, and there's just a guy with a broom shoving it up the puppet to make the head come off. And like on set it looks amazing, or in the movie it looks amazing. On set it looks fucking hilarious. Yeah, there's like, yeah, nine people just doing crap just outside the camera frame, but none of that matters. All that matters is what's in that box. And that's what you have to remember.
Which is, you know, that's why I love about indie films. You know, I mean, because at the time The Thing was an indie film. Now it's one of the most popular of all time. But, oh, yeah, you know, at the time it came out, it was, you know, it wasn't a big hit or anything. But I just love some of the ingenuity of you know, stuff you guys come up with for doing some of these independent films. So I had a couple other things here. So some of the labels on the food cans and the weed killer were designed by a graphic artist, Julius von Brunk.
Yes.
Right?
Yep, baronvonbrunk.com. So, yeah, he was...
tell me a little bit about...
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, tell me a little bit about that, because I saw that you had put some ex-girlfriend's names on it and some puns for, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and some things like that.
Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of jokes on there. Yeah, he's a graphic designer who was a friend of mine from years ago, and he designed all of our labels. He's excellent at mimicking products. So we had, my favorite was that we had chili, because you can't use real products in your movie, obviously, because, you know, the companies own them and they'll get pissed. So we designed all these cans. My direction was it has to look real. We can hide jokes, but it's an HD, so you have to be careful. You can't go too goofy or people will realize it, but it had to look real first and foremost. And every film you ever watch, there's going to be little jokes hidden because the set designers and stuff and the prop people, like that's what you do. So my favorite was was Lone Star Chili. And it has, I was like, I want a Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 joke on here. So it says it's no secret, it's the meat. And then it's, if you read the can, it's like, you know, based on the Sawyer family's like classic recipe, blah, 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 utilizing only the finest meats and hard shell peppercorns. Like there's just all these different little jokes. And if you know, you know, you know, you know, but if to a normal person, it just looks like a real can of chili you'd see at the store. And then we had Farmer Ezra was one of the names of our, all of the like canned peaches and stuff. And the, carrots and beans. Ezra Buzzington, who is an actor friend of ours that was in like Fight Club and Zodiac. He was on the hell is that show, the pirate show with John Malkovich, Crossbones. That was on a few years back, but he's everything. He's a character actor, so we wanted to pay homage to him, so we made Farmer Ezra's stuff with his picture on it. And then when I was in high school, I had a communications tech teacher named Mrs. Dorman, who, that was my video production course. This woman hated me, and I hated her just as fervently. So the last day of class, she told me that I would never succeed in film. So when we won our first film festival award, it was for Demonstration of the Dead. It's an old short we did. I was actually invited back to my old high school to be a guest speaker. So I brought a DVD of the short, and I brought the award in, and I knocked on her door, and I showed her, and I handed her the DVD. I'm like, hey, remember me, you know, and she threw it away in front of me and shut the door in my face. So on the weed killer, we have Tough on Dorman Weed, which is about her, because I just was not a fan of that woman. So that's my little tribute to her. I hope that one day she watches the movie and sees that, because I made sure to get a nice juicy close-up of that line of text on there.
That's great. So yeah, so you put some ex-girlfriend's names on the back too. What was the inspiration for that?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think. Did I?
Yeah, that's what. That's what the trivia says. I don't know. So I mean. That's
I don't know. I didn't write the trivia. I'm not sure that that's.
Yeah, because I was gonna say that. I was gonna say I wonder how that would go over with the people. So.
Yeah. I don't know. That I mean, there might have been something on there, but.
Oh, maybe it's Julius's names actually of ex-girlfriend.
Oh, that's probably what it was.
Yeah, it doesn't specifically say. Yeah. But
so I have a question for Mike Lombardo, the writer.
Sure.
And I want to do a deep dive on this movie.
Okay.
And by deep dive, I have a question that I gotta ask you as the writer, since you know, right? So it bugged me a little bit, but I think I understand. And spoilers, if anybody's, you know, listening, you need to go watch the movie and shut off the podcast right now. But he's the last kid, right?
Yes.
Because that's why he's the last kid. He believes in Santa, and that's why Santa has to kill him, right?
Yes.
I thought so.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a weird turn, man. Where did that come from? Because it's like, it's I'm like watching, okay, this, I've seen this before, but it's okay. You know, I'm having a good time with the movie, but it's, you know, it's like post-apocalyptic and she's gonna, and you know, and the cookies and all the stuff. And I'm like, okay, I know what's going on. And then all of a sudden, friggin' like real Santa Claus with the real magic list shows up in the wasteland. And I'm kind of like, wow, that took a turn. Where did that come from?
So that's been a big point of contention for a lot of people, it seems, because people either get it entirely or they don't understand why Santa shows up. And I'm glad that you understood that who's the last child. In the short story, it's a lot more explicitly clear because most of the story is actually framed through Santa's eyes. So you get a lot of internal monologue, so it makes more sense. And the struggle I had when I was writing the movie was, how do I explain that plot point in a movie that's, one, already minimalistic on dialogue, and two, with a character that doesn't really speak? So it was difficult to figure out how to portray that clearly. But the whole idea with Santa, the whole point of the movie for me was that the world doesn't let innocence survive. It was something that I was struggling with at the time, with my, like I said, my mom being in the hospital, and I had gone through some very nasty breakup, and then also I had a few friends die of cancer in that same time period. So it was basically, I was at a point in my life where I felt like I finally, the much talked about real world finally caught up to me, because I was in my 20s at the time. And basically I started to see that the universe had teeth. So I was in a real bad place, and I was just kind of mulling over a lot of things. And one of the big things that I thought of is, I was like, you know, as a kid, you know, everything is magic and new and fun. But the older you get, the more shit that happens to you, the more people you lose. Essentially, we all just become walking piles of scar tissue. And that was a thought that was running through my head a lot. And Santa, to me, is kind of like the ultimate symbol of innocence. You know, it just represents all that's magical and wonderful with the world as a child. And I just was kind of like, you know, as I wrote the movie, like the whole wasteland, the whole apocalypse of it is really just, it's the real world encroaching on this relationship between this mom and this little boy. And it's just, it can't last. And, you know, eventually you have to grow up. And despite the mom's best efforts to protect the little boy from all of that and try to shield him from what's happening, and my favorite scene in the movie is when they're hanging Christmas decorations over top of the bomb shelter, and there's literally a scene where she's putting garland over the gas masks that are left behind. And I just thought, if there's that's like the most beautiful visual metaphor I could possibly think of at the time. And I'm like, this is exactly what we do day to day, is we try to forget that we're going to die and that everyone we love has an expiration date. And, you know, that the older we get and the longer we last, the more horrible things are going to happen to us. And that was a really dark place that my head was in for a while. And then I started to come to realize that the magic of the world doesn't necessarily go away. It's just, it's now our job as the next generation to shield the younger generation from that. And that's what the myth of Santa Claus and stuff is. You want to give that magic to the kids. You don't want them to grow up. You know, my nephews at the time were 5 and 8, and my 8-year-old nephew, it was Christmas Eve, and I'll never forget this. And I was like, so, you know, did you write your letter to Santa? And he's like, Santa's not real. And my younger nephew was standing right there, and I was just like trying to change the subject because I didn't want that conversation to happen. And he just kept insisting. And, you know, they went off to bed, and I was hanging out with my brother downstairs, you know, talking. And about 2 hours later, I heard this creaking on the stairs. And, you know, I saw out of the corner of my eye, one of the kids walking down the stairs, and I'm just like, you know, they're obviously trying to like snoop for presents. So I'm not going to blow up their spot, you know, I'm their uncle. So I just let it go. And, you know, he scampers back upstairs. And the weird thing was, he didn't actually go to where the tree was. He went, he went into the kitchen, and I went out there and I looked, and there was milk and cookies set out, and it was a letter to Santa that he had written. And because I'm like, the little son of a bitch, he still believes. He just was embarrassed. He was at that age where he's kind of testing things. And it made me teary-eyed. And it was such a beautiful thing. And that was a big thing when I wrote the story, that kind of came about too. But yeah, I mean, really, if you look at the movie, the little boy is the only innocent character in the entire movie. He's the only one who doesn't do anything horrible. and the world wants him dead. He can't survive. Like, as soon as that movie starts, it's like, this kid can't survive. It just, it won't happen. I'm sorry, I'm going off on a real, real tangent. I hope that answered your question.
After you told that lovely story about your nephew, now I have to say something horrible, which is like, I'm watching it. Well, first of all, I don't understand how anybody would not understand the Santa Claus thing, because as soon as she pulls the list out and it's like glowing and clearly magical, it's like, oh, that's not just some weirdo walking through the wasteland.
Yes.
That's actually Santa Claus. So I if anybody missed that, it's because they weren't paying attention, I think.
So, and then that was why I put we went back and forth about the magic scroll a lot, if we were going to do that or not, because it was really like out there, but I guess that was Santa Claus. And I've always had a weird obsession with Santa Claus in horror movies, obviously. But I wanted the audience to think that it was going to be the dad coming back dressed as Santa Claus. And that was one of the arguments that we had a lot about cutting out the magic scroll, was because up until that point, you could still think, oh, it's the dad is going to come back. And then the family has committed suicide. And oh, no. And I was like, but that's what I would expect if I was watching this or reading it. And it didn't jive with me. And I mean, mostly the reason that I wrote the ending the way I did, it was just literally it was the emotional state and stuff. Like, it was the point I was trying to get across, not so much what was the clearest narrative, which, one of those lessons you learn when you make a movie, if I could go back, I would make that a little bit clearer and avoid the angry reviews where people are like, this doesn't make any fucking sense.
Honestly, I'm fairly certain. Well, no, you know what? I've been doing this a long time. Hey, the people who don't get that and the people that are angry about that and don't understand the ending, they just couldn't have been paying attention. So I wouldn't feel bad about that, because I thought it – and I got to be honest with you, my man. The movie, I'm watching it, and I'm kind of like you said, it's the dad, he's going to come back, they're going to be dead, okay, I get it. And then, man, you threw that curveball, and I was enjoying the movie. It's a very well-made movie, but I'm kind of like, yeah, okay. But then when you hit with that curve, man, that just, like, that hooked me. That hooked me, and from at that point right there, you had me. You reeled me right in as a viewer, and I've been doing this for over 30 years, reviewing movies and being a nerd over them. And man, it's not very often that a film grabs me like that. That was great. So I was about to say before, you know, you had that lovely story about your nephew and everything. Man, you know what went through my head after, as you know, the mom's crying. I gotta tell you, what went through my head at that point is like, how long has Santa Claus been walking around the wasteland taking kids out?
Yeah, that was another thing that people ask about. That was another plot point that we had discussed a lot. A friend of mine thought that it should. Well, so we had one screening and someone came up to me and they're like, you know, that was really fucked up that Santa had this bag of children's bones. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm like, that's cool. It was like a heavy metal album cover, but like. And they had said that the sounds, when we did the Foley for the movie, I used actual, like, old-school children's toys, like wood blocks and, like, a tin soldier. We had a bunch of different stuff just to give because I wanted that, like, vintage sound. But what I didn't realize is when you put it all together in the mix, and because I knew it was just supposed to be presents, I had, like, a little xylophone in there. But it does sound almost like bones. And if you look at it in the context of the movie, it's like, oh, wow, that's actually a really interesting read on it. But that wasn't what I wanted it to be at all. Like, it was literally Santa was supposed to be wholesome Santa Claus who just he exists only in the belief of children. He is just the symbol of innocence. So with there only being one little boy left alive that still believes in him, his energy levels are down. Like he's barely alive and he just wants to die. So the thought had never even crossed my mind. And then a friend of mine was like, dude, you should make it where he's going around killing all these other kids. And I was like, you know, that's really cool, but it was not quite where my head was going with it. But I do love that. And I think that would be, if I ever did like a comic adaptation of it, I think I'd probably add that in there.
Or you could do a prequel. Everybody loves prequels now.
Yeah, that's been the guy who plays the dad, Damien Maffei, who was in he was the killer in The Strangers Prey at Night. He's in Haunt, the new Wrong Turn reboot. He's on my ass constantly about doing a sequel or a prequel about the dad. And the running joke on set was that he has another family in a different bomb shelter that he actually snuck off to go over and hang out with them. that he wanted to find out like what happened to Simon. And I thought that would be really, really hilarious. But yeah, we could do a prequel, the Further Adventures of Doomsday Dad. And that's actually another question that people always ask, like, well, what happened to, like, I love it when we do Q&As because the audience gets so angry because they're like, well, what ended the world? And I'm like, you don't need to know. And they're like, well, what happened to the dad? I'm like, well, the movie's told entirely from the point of view of the mom. She doesn't know what happened, so why should you? Like, why do you get to know what happened? And I was like, how many times in your life do you get closure on anything? You know, nothing gets wrapped up in a nice little bow. You don't get to say goodbye to people. It's, you know, they leave for work and they get hit by a truck or something. You know, it's just, that's how it is. I mean, obviously in my head, the dad's dead. Like, obviously.
Yeah. But you also planted that neat. You also planted that neat Easter egg with the sister and the dead brother that something attacked them, and we never find out what the hell attacked them.
Yep, exactly.
So there could be a monster out there. You know, it could just have been a dog or a wild dog or something. But that's yeah, sick. No, I love the fact that there's like shit that you don't know and you don't have to know, because that means as a viewer, I get to fill in the blanks.
Exactly. And I've heard so many cool theories from people like yourself at screenings, and like people come up with the craziest shit. I love it. And it's funny because that scene originally was actually going to be way crazier. Like, she was going to go into this house, and I had two versions of it written. That one of them was she walks into a room and she finds there's like a skeleton cocooned to the wall with like this like fleshy mass, and there's just bodies cocooned everywhere. And then that she finds this wounded girl and she's like, oh my god, it's gonna come back. And the whole scene plays itself out. But I wanted to really amp up the monster end of it. And then the other version of it was the mom is walking through this abandoned house and she walks down this hallway towards the camera, and out of the doorway behind her you see a completely naked man wearing nothing but a gas mask with a skinned face over top of it. Like, the nozzle of the gas mask is coming out of the mouth of the skinned face. And he's just walking in unison with her, step by step, getting closer and closer. And then when she goes to turn around, he sidesteps into another room. And, like, the idea is that he's, like, a weird cannibal guy. And I had this whole thing, and I was like, this is so fucking cool, but has so, like, it's not going to fit at all. Like, everyone would be like, oh, my God, what was that? And I had all this stuff, and I'm like, it's just not that movie. I wanted to keep it down. I wanted to keep it as minimalist as possible and keep it just about this mom and her guilt and the hopelessness of the situation. And I'm like, if I do another apocalypse movie, I'll do all the crazy, like, fun stuff. But otherwise, I'm going to leave it to the audience to kind of fill in the gaps with that stuff. And obviously, part of it was budgetary as well. If I didn't have the money to do a cool flesh hive, but, you know, one day.
So I wanted to ask you about working with a child actor, Reeve Blasey, who played Riley in it. I've been, you know, from people that have worked with children in film, they say it's a pretty tough thing to do. So I wanted to ask you what it was like having to film him, especially being that it's such a, you know, a confined, you know, intimate setting where it's just him and the mother and they're, you know, and just in the room and whatnot. And so how is it, you know, because the kid's bouncing off the walls usually and stuff. So how is it getting him to sit down and do those scenes?
It was the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. When we were casting for that role, I saw probably 5 or 6 different kids. And I was lucky because we ended up with Reeve. He was the son of a friend of mine, Matt Blasey, who I worked with before. So he was actually the last kid that we saw. And the thing is, you can't really audition a kid because kids don't act. They just react to stuff. So I would have these kids come over and I just kind of talk to them about like what stuff they were into and just kind of get a feel for their personality and mostly their energy levels. Because, you know, the one kid was like really into WWF and he's like fucking suplexing on the couch. And I'm like, yeah, this is not going to work. So Reeve was kind of, you know, middle of the road as far as energy levels. And he was in, he had the look. And so the next stage was I had to send all the parents the short story and the script, because that right there like cut half my potentials out, because before they even came over, I'm like, hey, here's what's going to happen in the movie. And the parents are like, nope, not doing it. So that's why we only saw like 5 or 6 kids. But the parents were super into the story. They're like, hey, this is cool. Reeve grew up around horror movies because he, you know, The Walking Dead and stuff. His middle name is Romero. So I was like, all right, so I don't have to worry about traumatizing him. So then I gave him some lines, and you know, I kind of gave him like some suggestions, and I'm just like, like I said, you can't ask a kid to act, but you can kind of give them like scenarios, like how did you feel when, you know, your dog ran away? Like, you know, I mean, that's not something I said, but like just stuff like that to kind of get them into the into that mindset, that mood, and then you would have them deliver the lines. The hardest thing about it was when I had him read some lines and I'm like, okay, I think this kid is it. Then I had to break the news to him about what was going to happen in the movie. And I was trying to be very delicate about this because, I mean, my online persona probably doesn't portray this as much as it is in real life, but like I'm a huge softy, like I'm a huge sentimental softy. So I cherish the magic of childhood a lot. And I really didn't want to ruin Christmas for this poor kid. So I'm like, you know, bud, you're going to get killed in the movie. He's like, yeah, I know. I can't wait. It's going to be awesome. And I'm like, so you're going to get killed by Santa Claus, but it's not the real Santa Claus. And he, I'll never forget this. He just stopped and looked up at me and he's like, well, duh, the real Santa's busy making toys. You can't put him in the movie. And I was like, you're so right. Oh my God.
I was going to say, does he believe in Santa? But yeah.
Yeah, it was that's just fantastic. My heart melted. I'm like, oh my God, this is the best possible scenario. So once that was out of the way, we cast him, and you know, the first day of the shoot, he comes over, and his mom walks up to me, and she's like, so on the way over here, Reeve asked me if there was gonna be commercials so he could use the bathroom during the movie, and it's just, I was like, oh my God, this kid has no idea like what this is gonna be. So after the first day of trying to convince him to not look at the camera, he has to look past the camera. He got used to that. By day three, he was running the slate. And he was like, we do a scene. And he's like, okay, I think we got that one. Let's do a safety and move on. And I'm like, what the? And everyone's like looking at me. And I'm looking at him like, he's right. So like, you know, all right, we got, you know, this kid's gonna take over my directing role here. But he, you know, I'd say by about a week in, he was consciously making acting choices, which was just wild to me. He was 7 years old at the time. Like, it was crazy. But he, you know, he was good. He got distracted a lot. Fortunately for him and for me, him and the mom got along really, really well. So when I cast Hope Bickley, who was our actress, I had the two of them. I gave them a play date where they came over one day to meet, because I knew that if the chemistry between them wasn't good, the movie wasn't going to work. So I put them in costume, and I just spent, like, I had them together for like 4 or 5 hours, and I had crayons and paper and crafts and all sorts of stuff. We just all sat down in the basement and just did stuff together just to get comfortable with each other. And when he first came over, he was a little bashful. He was sitting on the opposite side of the couch as Hope. By the end of the day, he was all but in her lap, helping her draw pictures of robots, and all the pictures that are in the bomb shelter, he actually drew all of that stuff. And we would do that in between shots. He was bored, he would draw things, and the two of them got along so well. And they both were playing an iPad game called Dragon Island or something, or Dragon Isle or something. So they were constantly, as soon as I'd yell cut, they both had their iPads out and they were like trading dragon eggs and shit like that. So that helped keep them under control. And then I'd also had the surprise of the day. So this was a really good technique that I learned, that you can trick kids into behaving with the dumbest shit, right? So I would go to like Party City and buy like just little trinkets or toys or candy or something. And every day we were on set, he would have a surprise waiting for him if he behaved himself the whole day and got all the shots we needed. So then every like midway through the day, if he was doing good, he'd get a hint. That hint would be like, today's surprise is blue. Because it was like a bunch of blue now and later candies or something. By like the second week, he got wise to it. And he's like, you know, I did a really good job with that last take. Why don't I get a hint? So I would end up giving this kid, was shaking me down for hints or extra surprises and stuff. But so like, you know, I give him a little action figure or something, and that, you know, kept him going. And then other times he would, like all the scenes where he's laying on that bed, he actually would just fall asleep. So that was great, because then we just roll camera on. It's like, cool, he's actually sleeping. We don't have to worry about it. The only time I really had a problem with him on set was the scene when the mom takes the gun out of the bag and she's loading the bullets into it. She's going to kill him and herself. I did not want him on set with a gun, even though the bullets were they were especially made, so they had no gunpowder in them. They were filled with sand, but we needed them to look real. So I had those made by a friend of mine who, you know, does gunsmithing and stuff. But I still, you know, he's like a 7-8-year-old kid, and he's obsessed with Call of Duty and that kind of stuff. And I didn't want him around guns because he kept talking about how cool guns were, and I didn't want to facilitate that any further. So I was very conscious about not having him in the room when we did any of that stuff, except the one shot when she's loading the gun and he's in the background. We did that scene because he fell asleep on the bed, and I was like, hey, and I was like, guys, get over here now. We're going to do this shot real quick. And then the gun was back in the safe and back in the car before he ever woke up. And then when we did his death scene, you know, every day I felt like such a monster. So I'm like, okay, now we got to practice you dying. So we'd pretend to strangle him. And I wasn't getting the reaction that I wanted from him. And a friend of mine who was on set that day, he's like, hey, Reeve likes wrestling, right? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, tell him to do the Undertaker when he's taking power from the urn. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? Because I hadn't watched WWF since I was like 10. So yeah. I said that to Reeve, and he instantly, I was trying to get him to roll his eyes back into his head and stuff, and he didn't understand what I was doing. As soon as I said that, it was like, boom. He's like, and I'm like, oh my God, that is amazing. So then, you know, we did all of that. And, you know, it was such a disturbing scene to shoot with him. Cause, you know, we're killing this kid. And like, we did our first take, and I called cut, and I just walked upstairs in the house we were shooting in. And I just had a moment. I'm like, what the hell am I doing? Like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I'm directing this 7-year-old. We're choking him to death. It's Santa Claus. And I'm like, there's just this weird, like, stark moment where like my life really just revealed itself in front of me. And I was like, boy, this is wow. But then I went downstairs, and like that day was one of the funnest days we had. Like, everyone was having a blast. That's the thing, you know, I always tell people that even Schindler's List has a blooper reel. You'll just never see it. You know, the more disturbing a movie is, the more fun everyone's having on set, because you have to goof around if it's that dark or you'll go crazy. So like that day was really fun. But when we had the Hope doing the scene where she's cradling him and screaming, that actually brought the whole cast and crew to tears in person. Like, that was a really rough day shooting that. That was the only time that, like, the heaviness of the movie, like, really, really hit. But he was great otherwise. He was an angel. And the thing is, you know, it took 3 years to shoot, so he was losing teeth during the movie. I'd get a call. It's like, yeah, Reeve lost another tooth. And I'm like, shit. So my first reaction is save the teeth. I don't know what we're going to do, but save the teeth. So I wrote a scene where his teeth are falling out from radiation sickness, and he was going to put them under the pillow for the tooth fairy. I was like, I'm not doing this. Like, it never got past the script stage with that one. Because I'm like, if Santa's real, then the tooth fairy is going to have to show up. And, you know, it's a rabbit hole I don't feel like falling down. But the joke on set was that he was going to hit puberty before the movie was done. That, you know, the end of the movie, he's like 18. He's got his own kid. But, you know, working with kids, it's not for everyone, but it was good fun. Long story short.
So I wanted to ask you, too, about Santa Claus becoming infected. What was the what was the thinking behind doing that? And I really enjoyed that, and the special effect that you did with, you know, it crashing down to the ground and all that with. So I guess you made a plaster head, and you actually smashed it and stuff as well?
Yes. So the original makeup for Santa, like, it was supposed to be him crumbling. Like, he was supposed to be coming apart because the belief in him is gone. So it turned out looking like some kind of weird radiation burn, which is what most people say when they see it, which is apt. But I had this beautiful makeup done, and it was I used 3D prosthetic transfers that were made out of Prozade, which is a medical adhesive they use to glue prosthetics onto people. And it was this new technique that was developed, so I really wanted to try it out. The problem with it is the prosthetics, I didn't powder them enough, so they're very sticky. And I had all the fake hair, the beard, you know, patches and everything. And it looked great. It looked exactly like I wanted it to. We get Santa to set. Hope, the actress, and Shannon Moyer, who played Santa, were old friends from the theater, and they hadn't seen each other in years. So as soon as they saw each other, they run across the room and just bear hug each other. And all the makeup smashed against his face on Hope's shoulder, and it completely jacked the makeup up. And I almost cried. I'm like, no! So it didn't look the way it was supposed to, but we couldn't afford to do it a second time. So I just kind of salvaged what I could. And I'm like, well, whatever. So that's my one big regret, is I really wanted to have pieces of it crumbling off and like falling to the ground and stuff to make that more clear. But his head, I took a life cast of his head from the shoulders up and then did a silicone mold of that and then basically poured a plaster shell out of it, which was in theory was going to be really easy. I'm like, oh yeah, hollow plaster head. I can fill it with ashes and stuff and then seal it. And then we just drop it and it breaks. What I didn't realize is that trying to slush cast plaster. So slush casting is when you have a mold, you pour material in it and you kind of swish it around and build up a thin layer by layer. And as it dries, you can build it up so it's hollow, as opposed to filling the entire thing as a solid head or solid plaster head won't break. I usually do that when I'm doing molds with, it's called UltraCal 30. It's a white gypsum cement that I use for mold making. And it's called UltraCal 30 because you get 30 minutes of work time with it. And as it starts to cure, it turns into like pudding. So you can literally scoop it up and, you know, build up your walls. Plaster doesn't do that. Plaster like snap sets. It, as soon as it starts to kick, it's just boom, it's hard. So I learned very quickly that plaster is also a lot weaker than UltraCal. So trying to slush cast it is a fucking nightmare. So when I finally, I would like guess like, okay, here's one that's like a quarter of an inch thick. Cool. Take it out of the mold, touch it, it crumbles. I'm like, well, that's not going to work. Half an inch thick. Okay, well, that's too thick. It doesn't break properly. So I went through like a dozen plaster heads before I finally got two that were the right thickness. And then I airbrushed them, did all the hair work, painted them up, and then filled them with ashes. And then when we shot the scene, it was the most nerve-wracking moment of my life because I'm like, I've got two of these things. At that point, I was like, $600 or $700 into this effect, which is not a lot of money on a normal movie, but Doomsday had a budget of $10K. So that was a significant portion of the money. And I had to transport them the half an hour to set and then get the dummy worked up. And we had three cameras running and I drop it the first time, the head shatters slightly off frame. And I was like, oh my God, you're fucking kidding me. So we had the second one. We go to drop it. It breaks in half and doesn't shatter. And I was like, oh no. So I scooped it back together, glued it. And then we did it like two or three times. The head was just slightly too thick. So the one that we ended up using was actually the last take where it finally just shattered exactly like it needed to. And I was like, thank God. So it was very, very nerve wracking. I learned a lot about building shatterable heads from that as well. But yeah, that was my favorite day was shattering that head, because like the whole production, everyone's like, when are we doing the head? When are we doing the head? I'm like, I'm saving it for last. And because meanwhile, I was actually building all the props as we were shooting. So that was like the big finale. And that was just a ton of fun doing that.
Well, as we wrap up here, I wanted to give you a chance to let people know where to follow you and to keep up to date with anything you got going on. And we're definitely looking forward to whatever you're doing next, because like I said, this is a fantastic Christmas film. If people haven't seen it, yes, it's a little dark and you know, macabre, but you know, for us horror nerds, that's right up our alley, you know, this time of year. So I really dug it. I think it's a great, great film, and just one of those ones that you happen to come across and you watch it and you go, wow, man, that's a gem of a movie right there. You know, like, I really appreciate that. And I like what I saw and what you did, what was happening. So, but yeah, where can people find, you know, keep up to date with your stuff and find you and check out Real Splatter and all that good stuff?
So you can find me at realsplatter.com. That's real with two E's, like a reel of film, because we shoot digitally. So it perfectly makes sense. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/realsplatter. You can look up my personal page, Mike Lombardo. I'm on Twitter occasionally. My old short films are on youtube.com/realsplatter. The best thing you can do, though, is to check out the Brilliant Terror documentary that is on the film festival circuit right now. It world premiered at Arrow Video's Fright Fest in London, and it just came to New York City Horror Film Festival and Another Hole in the Head in San Francisco. They filmed me for 10 years shooting projects, including The Stall, and it ends with the first day of White Doomsday. You get to see a glimpse of my personal life. You get to see all the filmmaking stuff. If you're not tired of hearing me talk already, definitely check it out. There's a whole host of other great guerrilla filmmakers in there as well. It's kind of like American Movie meets Nail Gun Massacre. That's what I tell people. That will be screening all over the place. Just keep an eye out for that. That's thebrilliantterror.com, I believe, and then Terror Brilliant on Twitter. And Doomsday you can find at ScreamTeamReleasing.com. which is our distributor. They have a whole ton of excellent indie films. Lots and lots of great stuff. You should check out all their titles. They're really good. If you're familiar with The Barn or 1031, that's also the company that made those. You can buy it on Amazon. It's Target.com, BarnesandNobles.com, all those places. But if you do it for Screen Team, we actually get money, which helps us make a new movie. So not to sound too mercenary, but check it out there. It's also cheaper than Amazon. But yeah, feel free to hit me up on any of those social media platforms. Check out the movie. Check out The Brilliant Terror. Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all the kind words. You have made my heart swell three times this day, as they say.
Yeah, you just mentioned, I forgot to ask, but you just mentioned, yeah, you have a small role in The Barn 2, correct?
I do. Yes, I cameo in The Barn 2. I don't know if it's going to make it into the movie because I'm an actor. Yeah. I am not. But yes, I am.
We had Zane on just not too long ago. So, yeah, we talked to him a little bit about The Barn 2. So
yeah,
I wanted to make sure I got that little plug for you. So
I'm very excited to see The Barn 2. I got to be in the video store scene, which is near and dear to my heart. So I dressed as 90s Mike, like middle school Mike. So equal parts exhilarating. Nice. And embarrassing to look back and be like, Jesus Christ, I actually dressed like that.
All right, sir. Well, we'll let you go. Thank you. Appreciate it. It was, fun. Great time. So appreciate everything. And we're looking forward to whatever you're doing next.
Awesome. Thank you. I look forward to seeing your short film, man. Keep me posted.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. It's in post-production. We'll get there pretty soon. But I should have it out to some film festivals as of next year. So
excellent. Good luck.
Thanks. You too.
And that'll do it for this edition of In the Mouth of the Monster. For John Schatzer, I'm Monster Dugan. Stay safe. Merry Christmas.